From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a small town in southern West Virginia. Here, in what used to be coal country and in what still purports to be coal country, the opioid epidemic is at its worst. Scores of people are dying each year, and in this small town, two brothers feel despair. They're out of work now. One lives with depression but does not have medication. The other has turned to heroin, but the heroin he's buying is laced with other substances, some of them extremely deadly. Both brothers are in danger of dying premature deaths, and they are part of the face of America's complex psychological problems leading to this. Life expectancy in the United States declined in 2016, and that is a trend likely to continue throughout 2017. Drug-related deaths and suicides are big contributors, but there's no single easy answer for why a developed country like the United States is seeing life expectancy getting shorter. This hour, we're going to have a discussion about what's happening, what the data do and do not show us, or at least what we do know and what we don't yet know, and what might be done about it. I'll go ahead and welcome our guests. In studio, we have Eric Kane, who is a professor of psychiatry and also director of the Injury Control Research Center for Suicide Prevention at the University of Rochester Medical Center that is funded by the CDC. Eric, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be here again.
Jim Wesley is a clinical and forensic chemist. He is the former supervisor of the drug section of the Monroe County Crime Lab. Jim, welcome back to the program to you.
Thank you.
And Kent Gardner is on the line with us, principal with the Center for Governmental Research in Rochester. Kent, always good to have you. Thanks for taking the time for us.
Good morning, Evan. Nice to be here.
Well, let's go ahead and ask all of our guests to kind of share their first take on this, because what I don't want to do is have the audience misunderstand. Life expectancy is down a tenth of a percentage point combined, I think. Eric will tell us a little bit more about that in a second. But going down at all is a red flag, I think, for a country like this. So, Eric Kane, you sent along some notes when this data started coming out, and you wanted us to kind of keep this top of mind. Why?
Well, for one thing, it's the second year in a row. So this is the beginning of a trend which actually has been evident during the past decade, which is, in particular, people in the mid-30s to the mid-64, 65 years old, have seen a marked increase in mortality due to two things in particular. Suicide is one of them, things that my colleagues and I work with, but also opioid deaths. And the opioid deaths, in fact, while they started at a lower rate than the suicide, now has actually surpassed it. But when you start to look, as the term we use, upstream, not at the day of death, but in the days, weeks, months, and years before, we see that these often have common roots in terms of family turmoil, loss of jobs, economic circumstances, legal problems, and in particular in communities where there's been a lot of economic and social disruption. And this is a trend that actually has been developing in this age group in particular for the last decade or more that some of us have been tracking, and is becoming so powerful that it's having an impact on the overall population level of mortality. So it's something that was below the surface. It's now broken through. We're seeing it, and we haven't had a good answer or set of answers on what to do yet.
Okay. It is certainly remarkable. And Jim Wesley was telling me before the hour began that, you know, for a while in your career at the Monroe County Crime Lab, you might see one new drug cycle through and cases of a new drug once every 10 years or so. And that really changed when?
That changed in 2010. When the K2 spice, the synthetic marijuana, and the mollies started showing up, which really were slight structural changes onto illegal drugs, which made them temporarily legal and allowed to be used.
And now that's exactly the scenario, but in a much more deadly form. And those other drugs, of course, can be deadly and are deadly. But we're seeing it with heroin here. And what we're going to do this hour is also work through what is happening in sort of in this world of opioids, heroin, fentanyl. Jim's going to be able to explain that for you this hour. But for you, what's your big takeaway when you see the mortality rates and when you see life expectancy decline in this country, Jim?
When we looked at the drugs that we were seeing starting around 2016, the fentanyls really started to show up. And these are the ultra-potent drugs that basically are much stronger than heroin and are more difficult to stop the death during the overdose. They, from the police departments, 3, 4, 5 uses of Narcan to be able to stop the death, and even sometimes that didn't work. And as the labs, not just our lab, but the labs in Northeast drilled into what we were seeing, 5 years ago we would see heroin submitted, and all he had had, and it was heroin. That was all that was there. Now there's 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 10 different drugs mixed in with the heroin, and that causes both a problem with treatment. It also affects organ systems in the heart. Some of these drugs directly affect the heart. So now it becomes much more difficult to stop that death and then even figure out why the person died, because it's a multi-drug situation.
Okay, Eric?
Yeah, I would add, though, in other parts of the country, we have to be kind of mindful that this started even before 2010, and things like OxyContin and the prescription drugs, which, you know, we had drug mills, you know, and, you know, I'm not going to comment as a lawyer on the litigation around the country now, but there is a substantial amount of litigation across the states because, you know, enormous quantities of drugs were shipped, prescription drugs were shipped to pharmacies in places like West Virginia, Ohio, out west, and where there's less control than, say, in New York State, which has been a pretty controlled and careful state. And, you know, people in my profession, physicians, would overprescribe or would obviously prescribe amounts that could not be taken by one person. And pharmacies were selling enough for, you know, everybody in West Virginia and more in certain areas. And so this is a drug epidemic that in some ways is partly medically generated. And the medical profession certainly has to look at itself in the mirror and understand that while, you know, the drug companies in the mid-90s said, well, these new classes of compounds, oxycodone, being supposedly less addictive, you know, this is an old story. It goes back to the 1800s. Morphine was supposed to be less addictive. Heroin was later on supposed to be less addictive. And we've had this story over and over and over again. And there's been a lack of attention until very recently on physician behavior, on what's going on in the broad communities and selling these things. And so this is really cut across all parts of society. The thing that's most striking, though, certainly from my perspective, is that it's been driven by people in the middle years as the greatest mortality in terms of partly the baby boomers were a big generation. But it's been something that is a very, very fundamental change in the United States. Mm.
Jim, you want to add to that, and then we're going to turn to Kent. Go ahead.
Yes, certainly, because when we went from 80 million prescriptions of narcotic drugs before 96, and then when Oxy came in and we went up to 250 million, but people don't remember that before 96, if you wanted a narcotic drug, you'd get Percocet. It had 5 milligrams of oxycodone. When OxyContin came out and then you had an 80 milligram pill, that's like you took 16 Percocets at once. That's a tremendous amount of narcotic, and a lot of people created an absolute addiction.
Now, Kent Gardner, we turn to the Center for Governmental Research to help us understand our world better, to take a look at data and to kind of make sense of it. So for you, when you see the life expectancy in the United States 2 straight years decline, and that's a trend that could well continue, at least into the short-term future, where does your mind go? What do you start looking for to help understand that?
Well, you know, Eric referred us to the case in Eaton, mentioned the case in Eaton study that's from Princeton. And, you know, what they have done is disaggregated the statistics. So, you know, as you've mentioned, the when it actually hits the life expectancy for all Americans, then suddenly we look up and take notice. But it looks like a small number. So, you know, at first blush, you know, you say, gee, this is probably within the margin of error. You know, it hasn't really gone down. You know, it's really just a statistical aberration, and we'll see this reassert its historic trend. But if you take a look at some of the numbers that got in this case in Deaton study, they have disaggregated this and pointed out that in particular subgroups, you know, this isn't an error. This isn't a statistical aberration. It's finally hit the total just because the changes underneath that are so substantial, particularly among people with only a high school education or less than a high school education. I mean, they've got, they point out in one place that for individuals age 50 to 54, the average annual percent change in mortality for white non-Hispanics has increased by 5.4% on average over from 1999 to 2015. I mean, that is a stunning number, 5.4% average every year. So it's really a stunning statistic. It says, the aggregate number, we shrug our shoulders and say, gee, it's a really small number. But when you take a look at individual subgroups and realize that within certain subgroups in America, they're deeply, deeply hurting. And, as Case and Deaton identify these as deaths of despair, their category, drugs, alcohol, and suicide. That's the mortality increase that I was citing, 5.4% drugs, alcohol, and suicide.
And Kent, when it comes to despair, Jim and I were kind of talking before the hour began about these so-called despair indexes that you have seen come up, where they actually categorize things or kind of put numbers next to counties in this country where the rates of suicide, depression, drug use, and drug death are at the highest. And what we do see is that the counties with the highest despair index, so to speak, are the counties that went heaviest for Donald Trump. And I am not bringing this up to sort of peddle a narrative without data. There is data there to support that. What I'm asking you is, is it wise to look at policy as it relates to mortality, as it relates to life expectancy? Is it too complex? Are there certain narratives that are emerging that we can understand better here now?
Well, I don't know about policy, but I think one can certainly understand the deep level of dissatisfaction among certain subgroups. Again, people without a higher education, individuals who really haven't even gotten past high school, who in previous generations were able to get a well-paid factory job. They were able to be part of the middle class, and yet over the last 20, 30 years, they have seen their previous status loss. So we have people, the 50 to 54 age group, for example. These are people, many of whom have lost their jobs in manufacturing. They've moved from the middle class down the income spectrum. They have found it very difficult to find a new job that comes anywhere close to the job that they used to have. And then they think back to their parents. I mean, these are people who grew up as part of the middle class. Their fathers had good jobs in steel or in auto, and they were able to, again, stay very firmly in the middle class. I mean, people in the 1950s, working in the manufacturing sector were a very large portion of the middle class, and they had a very good life. And now, these individuals look back and they say, gee, this wasn't the way it was when I was a kid. I thought, like everybody else thought, that I would be better off than my parents' generation, and yet now I'm just distinctly worse off. So despair is a reasonable reaction to that. And I think that, to the extent that some of us, and it's a little hard, you're trying to be delicate about this as well, Evan, but, I do think that a lot of the votes that we saw in the most recent election do reflect a belief that the whole world is stacked against me as an individual voter. And I'm going to vote for someone who's really going to break things up in a significant way. So, I don't think that the election result is unrelated to this concern about people's future.
Yeah, and so let me turn to our guests in studio. Before the hour began, when Jim and I were talking about some of these issues, it occurred to me that I've talked to Jim many times over the years in your work as drug section director, a supervisor of the Monroe County Crime Lab, as a chemist. And most of the time I talk to you about drugs, what they are, how they work, what certain case studies are finding. More and more when you and I talk, you're out there, you're talking to people about opioids, and you come back and you're hearing about the loss of the American dream.
Exactly it. I was at the Gates to Recovery last week, and we actually had people come in who I think were still somewhat addicted to heroin at some level. And they said, back in, a parent said to me, back in 1980, you could go to Kodak with a high school education and put film in boxes and make $50,000 a year and then get a $10,000 bonus and go buy furniture. And where is that? And the thing is, I don't think that's coming back. I think people think it might be back, and I think that's what's kind of propelling them forward, that maybe we can return to what this was. But I don't think it's coming back, and I think we're going to have to change a paradigm change in what makes us happy and how we can move forward to stop this. Because right now we're trying to escape. I don't want to say we, but people just want to escape. And when they're using heroin, when they use oxy, they move to heroin, they're escaping from both physical pain and emotional pain of their whole life, and then they never can get back to square one. That's it.
Eric Kane, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to pick up on that, but I also want to pick up on something that Kent was saying, and actually that you mentioned, Evan. And if you look at the United States, these deaths are not, you know, uniformly spread across the country. They're you know, the jargon is they're geospatially distributed. There's a map, and you can actually look on the map and say where there's a where's a higher concentration, where's a lower concentration. This is attracting attention now, even though some of us have been writing about these issues for a decade or more, in part because it's spread from inner cities, where you'd say, oh, you know, your destiny is your zip code, to across the country. It's spread from, you know, minority populations where, you know, frankly, the general society cared less, to the broader general
population. And Eric is not saying should care less. Eric is saying, honestly, that's what's been happening.
Right. Yeah, and okay. Now it's the general population in a much broader swath. This isn't to say that the opioid epidemic or this, you know, isn't hitting inner cities or the suicide isn't hitting rural areas. Of course it has. In fact, we know that the opioid deaths have surpassed in rural areas at a rate or caught up with the inner city rates, and even surpassed as in the last year or two the death rate, not the numbers. Suicide has been for 40, 50 years higher in rural areas than urban areas. It in the beginning of the 20th century, it was higher in urban than rural, but eventually, as so much wealth moved into the cities and farming was, you know, lost a lot of income as a generative way of life, then it was a transition. So there are fundamental social processes in what we might call context, as well as what's going on with individuals. When you say that, you know, you have a change in manufacturing, there's no way that one individual is going to be able to control his or her destiny as Kodak collapses. You know, this isn't something that a person, you know, who's on the line can simply say, oh, yeah, I can make a difference. And so I think that one of the fundamental questions we face as a society, and this goes back to what Kent was starting to get at, which is what is the broader responsibility, even as we think about how do we help individuals in need? We know, for example, that access to healthcare varies tremendously across the states. So New York State, for instance, has a very well-supported Medicaid program. And a lot of the states where we're seeing these deaths being very high have, you know, very little in the way of Medicaid. And people talk about taxes and, you know, how much New York spends on Medicaid. We're the highest in the country. But actually, it shows up in the death rates. We have a much, much lower death rate for opioids, and we have a much, much lower death rate for suicide than many other many other states. Now, that doesn't mean that we aren't facing the opioid epidemic in New York.
Sure.
We sure are.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, at a population level, having all those resources and all the substance use treatment settings in our city and around our area. Now, the Southern Tier has less, and they have higher rates. It is even local that way.
So it tracks to healthcare disparities. And by the way, I chose West Virginia to open the hour for a specific reason. Jim, what is the number one state in the country for opioid deaths? Is West Virginia, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, so when the CDC released the report, I cranked the population numbers. And the May 2016 to May 2017, yeah, which is called fast track release, national average is 20.5 deaths per 100,000. West Virginia is 52. And Nebraska is 5.9.
So what is Nebraska doing differently than West Virginia?
Well, I think...
That's remarkable.
Well, I think like we talked earlier, I think West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, that was the Rust Belt, that was the old industry. There was a lot of back pain, a lot of other things.
Coal mining, too.
Coal mining. And the influx of the oxys and other drugs in the mid to late 90s just flooded that area. And then the pullback was, okay, heroin. If you look at this Nebraska and South Dakota, not only are their populations low, but the population is so spread out. I hate to say it, but it's almost not economical for the bad guys, to take heroin there.
Okay.
It's just too far off the beaten path.
But they do have somewhat higher suicide rates.
They do.
Interesting. Okay, so So that what an interesting and by the way, where New York State ranks. What's New York State's? The national average is 20.2 per 100,000 opioid deaths. What's New York State's rate?
And New York is 11.1.
Okay, so about almost half the national average, which speaks
to
Ed's
New York, and for suicide, New York is at the very bottom nationally. And so it isn't to say, you know, we are a big state, so there's a substantial number, but it points to the notion that if people can find places to ask for help, to seek help, if families can go somewhere and get help, it's not perfect, certainly. I'm not saying Rochester or New York are perfect, but it certainly makes a difference. And this was also shown in Europe, where when you have more public resources available, especially for people who can't afford the high deductibles, it can't afford the expensive health insurance, can't afford rapid access to care, having this public support is really essential for survival.
Now, Kent Gardner, I don't want to overly distill, but I do want to ask you about something that was raised recently by a very progressive writer, and that's Matt Stoller, who's a former Democratic Senate budget guy who's written for a number of different publications. He has been very tough on Obamacare. He points out that when it comes to mortality, when it comes to life expectancy, this did not all just start this year, that this trend was starting at the end of 8 years under President Obama. And Stoller's point was, for all of the left sort of extolling the virtues of the Affordable Care Act, we did not see a lot of great outcomes, or at least not in his view, not good enough. And I don't want to just say, well, that just shows the ACA was, you know, bad or ineffective or a problem. But I do think it points to how complex healthcare is when it comes to making good policy and why it does matter going forward. Unless, Kent, you don't think healthcare policy does impact mortality rates. It has to, though.
Well, I think it absolutely has to. When you look at the statistics comparing the United States to many European countries where access to healthcare is more routine and much more affordable, I think that's one of the only explanations one can draw, is that access to health care makes a difference to those mortality statistics. But, you know, in response to Stoller's point, there are a couple of things to be said about the Affordable Care Act. One is that we have to remember that some of the worst problems we have in terms of health care are in those parts of the country where the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion was turned down by the states. So we have a lot of states where Medicaid is, you know, for the poor, almost zero. I mean, it's really stunning when you take a look at states where, if you're poor and you're single, if you have kids, most states give you some level of support. But if you're single, a single adult, in some 20 odd states in the United States, you get nothing from Medicaid. I mean, you're just not covered at all, really. And that's really a stunning statistic. And the Affordable Care Act attempted to change that. But again, that went to the Supreme Court. The states said, gee, you can't make us do that. Supreme Court agreed. So individual states have been able to opt out of the Medicaid expansion. So I do think the Affordable Care Act was a step in the right direction. It has all kinds of problems. There are all sorts of implementation problems. I do think it was the right path to take. It brings us more in line with many other nations where the healthcare system is built on employers, it's built on private providers, it's built on private insurers, places like Germany, Taiwan, where they really do have a system that is like ours, except it's more heavily regulated and where you have lower costs. So I do think the Affordable Care Act was a step in the right direction. For those states to deny the expansion of Medicaid to people below 133% of the federal poverty line, I think it certainly explains many of the geographic disparities we're seeing right now. So I know that many people think that the Affordable Care Act was anathema. It's a little surprising to see some criticism from the left. I assume that Stoller's preference is that we go to a national health care system
that's
with
right.
a single payer,
yep.
which, you know, which also has its problems. I mean, that's not a perfect solution either.
Okay. I think one of the things that people miss, whether they're talking about Affordable Care Act or also employer-based insurance, has been there's a movement in the last 10 to 15 years for ever higher deductibles in order to keep your insurance rates down. You know, insurance is very expensive. So if someone has a $2,000 or $4,000 deductible for a family, they're often not going to go get care for things like a mental health problem. You break a leg, you're going to go. If you're depressed, you're not necessarily going to go. And so what we've seen over the last few years is while something called parity exists, you know, in terms of, you know, coverage is equal for mental health and substance use as it is for physical health problems, people tend to go less for things they think they can work out on their own. And the rise of the high deductible approach has actually undercut both the benefits that were thought to come with the ACA and with private employer insurance for many people, particularly those in the middle class and who can't afford, you know, to pay, you know, $10,000 for health insurance for a year for a family.
All right, we got to get our only break. Go ahead, Kent, and then we'll take our only break.
Yeah, just a quick comment about this. It's a bit of a hobby horse of mine. The rise of the deductible is directly related to the Affordable Care Act, and it's kind of an unanticipated consequence because one of the other things the Affordable Care Act did was to create this out-of-pocket maximum to eliminate the specter of widespread bankruptcy as a consequence of medical costs. The out-of-pocket maximum, if you just do the simple arithmetic, if you've got an out-of-pocket maximum of, I've forgotten what it is, $8,500 or something like that, it is nearly impossible for an insurance policy to have an out-of-pocket maximum that low and not change the rates dramatically and not have a deductible. I'm not saying it's the right outcome, but it's really directly related to the out-of-pocket maximum and also the those services that are required to be covered at no cost. So it is all related. Again, I'm not sure what the right solution is, but it's not an accident. It's not simple greed that has been driving those deductibles up.
All right. We're going to get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back. I've got a very good question from a listener who is going to help us guide our second half hour. We're talking about the decline, a slight decline in life expectancy. But that's 2 years running now in the United States, which if you think about developed nations, the trend should not be a lowering of life expectancy. But that's what's happening. It's related to suicide levels. It's related to opioid deaths, among other things. And our guests are discussing all of that and more. You just heard Kent Gardner, principal with the Center for Governmental Research in Rochester, on the line with us. In studio is Jim Wesley, a clinical and forensic chemist and the former supervisor of the drug section of the Monroe County Crime Lab, and Eric Kane, a professor of psychiatry and director of the Injury Control Research Center for Suicide Prevention at the University of Rochester Medical Center, which is CDC-funded. Let's get that break and come right back with them. We're going to talk about solutions, if there are any, sort of in reach here. It's complex, but we'll talk more about it next. Coming up in our second hour, how responsible do you feel for fake news? Yes, you or me or all of us. Are we to blame for fake news? We're going to hear an argument that the answer is yes, that it's our own fault, that we share way too much without verifying it, that we are way too prone to sharing stuff we like or that confirms our biases. We'll discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Listeners, if you want to call the program, you can do that. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We're talking about a slight decline in life expectancy in the United States, 2 years running, and all of the alarming things that are tied to that. Suicide, opioid abuse and addiction, and deaths related to drugs. And here's an email from a listener named Mark, and this is, I think, really well-timed here. Mark just says, let me pull up the email. He says, Evan, the issue with heroin has been, as one of your guests said, it's not just heroin anymore. I have personal experience with this, not myself, but a family member. I know how dangerous this stuff can be. And my first question would be simply, why can't we make fentanyl illegal? That's from Mark. It's a good question. And I will tell you, Mark, before having conversations with Jim Wesley, I kind of had the mindset that said, well, it doesn't really matter what is legal or illegal on the drug side because people who want to abuse it will. And my view changed a little bit with that after having a conversation with Jim, because you pointed out that when fentanyl really first sort of hit a number of years ago, it was sort of out there in the public realm and it was not technically illegal. And then they keep finding ways to make sure that it avoids legal scrutiny. How? So what's the story here, Jim?
Okay, so when fentanyl first hit, it was basically people stealing patches from nursing homes. And it was real fentanyl. When I say fentanyl, it was the fentanyl drug. And that's a Schedule II drug. It's legal. It's used for surgicals. It's very, very effective. What they do is they tweak the structure and they put a different a methyl group or some simple thing. And in the New York State law, if the drug is not specifically listed, it becomes not a drug at all. You can't arrest anybody. You can't do anything about it.
This sort of blew me away because it's as if there's a law that says no one can drive a Prius. Priuses are illegal. However, if you happen to have a Prius, if you just put a little tail fin on there, it's now technically not a Prius anymore and you can drive it. That's what they're doing with drugs. You know, so when Jim says when they tweak it, when they add a methyl group, that's sort of drug lab speak for they're just tweaking this a little bit to kind of change technically the nature, but it's still deadly, it's still dangerous, and now they're allowed to continue to put it out there. And every time the government whacks it, they tweak it again. Is there any way to get around this, or can you change the way the laws run to not allow this sort of whack-a-mole to happen?
There has to be a big restructure. So right now, furanyl fentanyl, you probably haven't heard of it, but that's an analog that showed up here in March of 2016. It's caused hundreds of deaths all through the state. But that and 10 other fentanyls are completely legal, meaning people can use them, sell them, overdose on them, die. You can't do anything about it. The law has to be totally restructured so that when the federal government, by the way, these are all illegal federally, they're just totally legal. So they're illegal federally, totally legal in New York. The law should be changed so that when it becomes a scheduled controlled drug by the feds, which are on top of this pile, they catch it before anybody, New York immediately should mirror that and put it in the law. Right now it has to go through bills in both the Assembly and the Senate. Then they have to vote on the bill. Then they have to go to the governor or the health commissioner. And by the time that happens, they just make a new one.
Okay. And so the reason I say my mind changed a little was I heard this and I thought, well, if we could find a way to change the legal structure to not allow this little tweaking to happen, then maybe these things wouldn't be so readily moving through the marketplace. But I don't know. Maybe, Eric, what do you think?
I want to bring in another perspective. Heroin's been illegal forever. Well, not actually forever, but certainly for 100 years about, roughly. And they started actually getting on it in 1914 with tax laws, something called the Harrison Tax Act. You have a situation where there is high demand. In a society like ours where there's high demand, there will be a way.
Yeah.
And the fentanyls in particular are so potent that the amount that's needed to smuggle it in is really tiny. And these things are made largely in China, not in the United States. I mean, fentanyl has its use as a medication, and the, you know, it's been used for a number of years now. But the, we'll call it the illicit drug trade is very clear that, you know, over time, I started working with people with substance use disorders in the 1960s, and there was mounting of all the war on drugs and all these kinds of things. And they've had really no significant impact except building a huge law enforcement and, you know, control capability. But, you know, heroin has become far more pure. And when I started working with substance using folks, it was cut with milk sugar and it was very, very impure, you know, 10% opiate and 90% milk sugar. It's now very pure substance. The world has gotten much more sophisticated much faster. So I think we're also talking about fundamental approaches to prevention, which are not law-based, but social-based. And we're in a society, you know, let's face it, the United States is a drug-oriented society. We have our legal drugs that are regulated, alcohol and other things, and we have our so-called illegal drugs. And so we have to find a way of walking up to what are very fundamental cultural questions. I'm not saying I can solve them today, but it's very, very clear that our drug-using society is one that, you know, we have pharma advertisements on TV all the time. So it's a complex problem, and simply labeling something illegal won't have necessarily much effect on its flow.
All right, so let me read an email from a listener named David, and then I want Kent and Eric to respond, because David is piggybacking off something Jim Wesley said earlier this hour. David says, Evan, how timely. We just finished Christmas, where every family seems to be competing with how many gifts they buy for their kids. And so many families now can't afford what they used to. Of course there is despair. Of course there is sadness. but we need to change the values that tell us that that is the measure of a person. I don't think we're going back to Kodak 1980, as one of your guests said, and I think we need to get back to the point that says we don't value ourselves based on our income. That's from David. Okay, so there's a couple of things. I'm going to start with Eric on the sort of the psychological side, and I also want to ask Kent Gardner, because we're going to go back to whether on the policy side, if we can just sort of give up and say we're never going to, because we're not going to go back to Kodak 1980, but are there other policies that might help? So, but Eric, on the psychology side, David is making the point that Jim did, which is if we think of the American dream in this way and people are feeling that despair, are we measuring the wrong things and can we change that?
Well, I think that this goes back to fundamentals about what our social values are. And I certainly agree that materialism as a broad social value isn't going to get us very far. On the other hand, I think there's a fundamental question in the United States about whether the paths to opportunity are open. And I always think of my parents who grew up in New York City. Their parents were immigrants. My father went to night school for 8 years to get his bachelor's degree while he worked and helped support his family during the Depression. My mother went to college and also worked during the Depression. My mother chose not to go to Hunter College because it required $50 a semester more than going to Brooklyn College, which was free. We don't have free education anymore. We don't open up the paths to opportunity the way we did. Kids coming out of the city schools in Rochester, for example, are not necessarily going to have the path to opportunity that kids coming out of the Brighton schools or the Pittsford schools or the Fairport schools. And so this issue of destiny by zip code, as we some people have called it, is really something that's quite profound. Same thing in West Virginia. I'm not trying to limit it to the cities here. And Kent got it at, you know, if a state chooses to not have Medicaid for certain families, then some kids are going to have ear infections and going to have problems with their hearing. They may not have their vision tested early in life. They may, in fact, start developing problems with their dental health. Their parents may not be educated about what it takes to have sound teeth and sound bodies. And so is it our social responsibility to do that? I mean, I particularly think it is. You know, maybe that's because I'm a healthcare worker and see it that way. But I think these are fundamental social questions that the United States has to walk up to. It isn't that everybody should be given a handout, but everybody should be given an open door, in my view. And education is one of the big ones, and healthcare is one of the others.
Okay, Kent Gardner, what do you think?
You know, the complexity of the policy problem is overwhelming. When I think about going all the way back to the issue of literacy and numeracy in the in our cities, I mean the challenge that we face with the Rochester City School District, the opportunities, as Eric points out, of the opportunities available to someone who gets out of school and either someone who drops out. I mean, again, the statistics are overwhelming that people without a high school education are deeply disadvantaged. But those individuals who, leave the city school district and graduate and go on to college, we have statistics that suggest that the percent of those individuals who actually succeed in college and end up getting a college degree is very low. And certainly that is the place at which we can have the most influence on people's futures is by giving them those basic skills. But beyond that, we have to struggle with how we deal with an economy that increasingly looks to a college degree as the entry point for a profession that perhaps doesn't need college at all. So I think we do need a complete rethink in terms of what particular kinds of jobs require in terms of education. We need to stop asking for a college degree for things that don't require. We need to be better able to direct people to places where they can gain skills that will allow them to feed their families. So certainly what happens at Monroe Community College and at BOCES is very important. But it's a moving target, and that's what makes this so extraordinarily difficult. As the economy continues to evolve and we see a greater movement of technology into occupations that we never thought would be susceptible to automation 20 years ago, it just becomes extraordinarily difficult.
All right, let me grab a couple of phone calls. Robert in Fairport first. Go ahead, Robert.
Thanks for taking my call. I think that the pharma companies are kind of being let off kind of easy on this. Bloomberg Business Week magazine wrote a cover story on this in their October 5th, 2017 issue that described in detail how this crisis kind of came about. And if you read the article, it sounds a lot like the financial crisis. There's a lot of similarities between the two, especially with mortgage companies writing these no-documentation mortgages. There was a lot of salespeople for certain pharma companies that made a killing selling these products. And according to the article, it stated that despite falling from its 2010 peak, the number of opioid prescriptions in 2015 was three times what it was in 1999. A lot of these pills were sold on the assumption that they were used for pain management and could be and were non-addictive for pain management. And it was a completely flawed and false assumption. And the pharma company should be held financially liable for this. Mm.
Yeah, Robert, thank you for that. Jim Wessel, you saw many of those cases go through the Monroe County Crime Lab. Do you agree with him?
Exactly. So what happened when the lobbying occurred by the pharmaceutical companies to make pain the fifth vital sign in 2001, the doctors have to ask you if you're in pain, and then they have to treat you. And that's why it pushed up the 200 million prescriptions. And making $3 to $5 billion a year off of these things, some of the states are actually doing class action now trying to come after them. But you're right. For every one that they try to take down, the prescription cutback is only about 20% from the peak. Can you imagine if it was cut back 50%, I'd probably have 10 times as many people going to street heroin. So how do you deal with people who are chronically taking these things over a long period of time? Not the 5 to 7 days for the tooth pull, chronic back issues. They've been on 240 Vicodins a month for 10 years. How do you deal with that? Because a lot of people are on it.
So Jim brings up a really important point that I just want to elaborate on, which is we look at the pharma companies as one of the, explosive qualities, because it really was an explosion almost, that really started this train running down the tracks. Mm-hmm. But the train's running down the tracks now, and we've got to figure out at several levels. One is, how do you help the people who are have had pain treatment and are addicted and need, you know, a lot of work in transition to other therapies? The second is, what do you do with all the people in the communities who are, maybe they didn't, they started with illegal oxy that was being distributed, because a lot of people took prescriptions and then sold them. And so these were people who didn't have pain, but they got illicit pills, oh, this will be good for you sort of thing, you'll have a great time, and then have switched over to heroin and fentanyl and other kinds of things. And the heroin is so pure now that some people start by snuffing it, and then they move to needles later on. So it's really a very complex problem. And while I agree that we should be really coming down hard on pharma companies that abused what is supposed to be an ethical obligation, at the same time, we face a future of lots of challenges now. In terms of what Kent was talking about, in terms of the car moving and having to change social policy, this is really a question of leadership, and I think this is a question of social discussion. And it's leadership in the medical community for the medical side of things, but it's leadership in the broader political community about whether people use this as a marker for some fundamental problems in the United States. And I, you know, for me, this is a measure when we start seeing people die this way, when we see the change in the, particularly the middle years population, which started a number of years ago, but as I say, it broke through the surface. And, you know, as Kent said, the numbers themselves for the overall population aren't big, but for these 50 to 54, it's actually, you know, you could look 35 to 64, it's a big group. And what will be the social changes that will help this group? That needs political leadership.
Okay. Back to the phones we go. Keith, next up. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan?
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Oh, I just heard a first-time tone, and I didn't know what that meant. Obviously, you must have a new phone system.
It is a new phone system. You're very perceptive, right. And you're on.
Not sure if you warned people. I got a question on gateway drugs. I'm a firm believer that New York State should follow other states when it comes to marijuana. But you get these holier-than-thou politicians who say, no, you can't legalize or make marijuana available or decriminalize it or whatever. because it's a gateway drug.
Like the governor. The governor said that, yeah.
And I if you've ever met a junkie or somebody who has a drug problem, they smoke. Personally, I believe that nicotine is the gateway drug, not marijuana. I know plenty of people who have tried marijuana and still use it, and they're functioning people in society with no problems whatsoever. But since they use marijuana, that's not good. And I think something should be done addressing that so politicians have the information to make the decision. Now, I don't know what's going on in Colorado other than the fact they're getting way more tax revenue than they anticipated. And California, I believe, has run out of marijuana from what I've heard. But maybe your guests would like to comment on that.
All right, Keith, thank you. I mean, first of all, I think Keith brings up an interesting question just because if you look at national polling, I think Gallup for the first time recently, a majority of Americans are now favoring full legalization. And but that states haven't moved as quickly. I mean, some states are still slowly moving on medical marijuana. Forget about full legalization. Eric?
Right. So, you know, one of the questions always as you start to have this discussion is it's a sort of a two-dimensional thing. One dimension is it legal or illegal? The other dimension, is it regulated or unregulated? So we have drugs that are legal, alcohol, cigarettes, and there's some forms of regulation to those. Certainly, you know, we try to regulate alcohol. It's not completely successful in terms of age. There's been a lot of pushback on things like how much can be served at bars, and that's been through litigation such that, you know, bars are much more careful or tend to be. So there's a kind of regulated use of alcohol, not perfect. Same thing with tobacco, again, not perfect. And then you have the unregulated drugs, where we try to use law enforcement techniques to keep them down. And those are certainly not perfect. So this is a big social discussion. It isn't so much gateway or not gateway, because you could get a lot of data on both sides of that argument. You know, is milk a gateway drug because people who drank milk?
Correlation is not causation.
Yes, we know that.
And
exactly.
If you go back to 1999, in a report commissioned by Congress to look at the possible dangers of medical marijuana, the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences wrote that in a sense that marijuana use typically precedes rather than follows initiation of other illicit drug use, it is indeed a gateway drug. But because underage smoking and alcohol use typically precede marijuana use, marijuana is not the most common and is rarely the first gateway to illicit drug use. There is no conclusive evidence that the drug effects of marijuana are causally linked to the subsequent abuse of other illicit
drugs.
That's 18 years ago.
So this gets to the question of how do you want to regulate? Do you want to do it openly with sort of social controls as well as legal controls, or do you want to try to use law enforcement?
Yeah. So we're down to our last 3 minutes or so. So I'm going to ask our guests for some final thoughts on the matter as we talk about declining life expectancy. Two straight years of a mild, modest decline, but tied to some very alarming trends with suicide, opioids and drug abuse and other things. Jim Wesley, some final thoughts. Go ahead.
So I think basically, like we have already discussed, we have to think of a different way to approach this. And I've been looking at this. I think, and this has to start with the schools and the parents, but we've never been good at what I call stress management at all. And that's when people's stress management is the general worry, tension, and stress of everyday life that everybody has, and we don't deal with it. We've never dealt with it, so that's why people drink, they smoke marijuana, and now they use heroin. Once they use heroin, pretty much that's it. I think all bets are off, and then the rest of your life is a narcotic. So how do we work stress management, I want to say tools, in the schools? Everything from Alfred State with the Mind Spa, which is a fantastic thing. Palmec has stress dogs. They have 3 dogs in the school that follow them to exams. And people say, why are they doing it? They're bringing down the stress and worry level. And then come up with tools, everything from meditation to yoga or whatever we can try to have a change in how we deal with stress. We're not dealing with stress. Time magazine put out a bunch of stuff on it. Mindfulness, happiness. This is serious stuff we got to start looking at.
All right, 30 seconds. Kent Gardner, final thoughts. Go ahead.
Yeah, terribly complex problem. We have to keep doing all the things that we're doing. There's no silver bullet. There's no single new policy that's going to work. We have to continue to reduce access to what we classify as illegal drugs. We need to change the path by which drugs become targeted by law enforcement. We certainly have to improve quality of education so that people have a job. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, if people don't have a reason to get up and go to work and can't feed their families, despair is a logical outcome. Mm.
And Eric Kane, final thoughts.
Well, I would think of this as somebody's put up the red flag at the top of the pole to say that there are problems out there, and it goes way beyond just these this decreasing mortality. And there needs to be a national discussion about how we're going to deal with this, as well as a discussion in our state and locally, because these problems occur in Rochester too.
We'll be back talking more about this and related issues. And I want to thank Eric Kane, a professor of psychiatry and director of the Injury Control Research Center for Suicide Prevention at the University of Rochester Medical Center, first calling this to our attention. Thanks for coming back and doing that, Eric. Appreciate it.
Always.
Jim Wesley, a clinical and forensic chemist, the former supervisor of the drug section of the Monroe County Crime Lab, who's doing a lot of hard work on this issue locally. Jim, thanks for the time and the expertise this hour.
Thanks, Evan.
Kent Gardner, principal with the Center for Governmental Research, on a holiday week, even willing to get on the phone for us. There's pretty much nothing Kent won't say yes to, and we abuse that with just reckless abandon. Kent, thank you. Happy holidays. Happy New Year. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, always, Evan.
Short break. More connections coming up.